Thank you all for coming to this latest in the Lannan series of readings and conversations. I'm Kate Moses, and it's my honor to introduce poet August Kleinzahler to you tonight. I'd also like to take this chance to again thank the good people of the Lannan Foundation who continue to bring some of the most exciting original voices in contemporary literature and contemporary thought to this beautiful theater in Santa Fe, and also make this ongoing series available to a wider audience through their website. They really have a vision and a generosity that's become a cultural gift. So thank you so much. Like Walt Whitman, William Carlos Williams, Allen Ginsberg, Frank Sinatra, and the Boss, August Kleinzahler is a proud native son of New Jersey. Though he has now spent nearly half of his years, perhaps to his bemused surprise, in the city of San Francisco, he has lived a life devoted to his craft, steering clear of the clubby, back-scratching institutional networks of the poetry world, while creating a poetry that is at once formally controlled, innovative, and bristlingly dynamic, informed by his attention not just to the rhythms and momentum of ordinary speech, but by his manifold fascinations, bebop and tofu, urban grit and hollyhocks and pets, sorrow and movies and schoolyard bullies, microbiology, and the romantic longing of catalysts. His first book of poetry, A Calendar of Airs, was published in 1978, and seven more major collections have followed, each one garnering him a mounting inventory of critical attention and recognition here and abroad, including the General Electric Award for Younger Writers, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Award, an award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the Berlin Prize from the American Academy in Berlin, and the Griffin Prize, one of poetry's most coveted international awards, as well as a Lannan Award in Poetry. His latest collection, Sleeping It Off in Rapid City, published in 2008, resulted in the California Book Award for Poetry and the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry. In 2005, Kleinzahler was named Poet Laureate of Fort Lee, New Jersey, his hometown, of which he is justly proud. In addition, he is the author of two books of nonfiction. Just out a few months ago is Music 1 through 74, a compendium of his wildly idiosyncratic music criticism, a revealing counterpoint to the percussive musicality and bluesy improvisations that are a signature of his poetry, and his sly, funny, and elegiac memoir of coming of age in a family in equal parts cultured and immoderate goes by the title Cuddy One Rock, Low Characters and Strange Places, Gently Explained. Surely everyone who's read this memoir has to agree with the Washington Post reviewer, as do I, that it is, quote, magical, a deeply moving, unpretentious, 155-page masterpiece. Not only should you read this book, but you really have to see the cover. I know it'll be hard from where I am, but you can see it out in the lobby later. It shows this priceless photo of the 5-year-old author in his cowboy getup, alongside his adored older brother, Harris, whose suicide at 27 was the devastating event that closes this book. And yet it was the pivotal experience that galvanized his younger brother's resolve to become a poet and live a different kind of life. This is the second occasion I've had the pleasure of introducing August Kleinzahler to an audience. The first time was almost 20 years ago, and I then worked for Intersection for the Arts in San Francisco. Intersection hosted about 100 readings and literary events a year, and I was the sole employee of the literary program, which meant I was like a one-man band. I was booking the writers and writing the publicity and running the box office and baking the cookies for the receptions I had after the readings. And I was also a single mother at that time, and invariably there were evenings when my nighttime babysitter just punked out on me, and I had to bring my little boy along to my evening events. So such an event was a reading I had scheduled with one of Intersection's very favorite writers, August Kleinzahler, and the Australian poet, John Tranter. My son Zachary was about 2.5 at that time, and I settled him with his blankie and his toys up on the mezzanine office at Intersection, which was overlooking the theater. And then I ran around downstairs taking tickets and replenishing the reception table and greeting the audience. When I finished my introduction, Augie, as all of his friends call him, had taken the stage first to give his visiting friend John Tranter the top billing in the second act. I looked up, and to my horror, I saw my little boy in his jammies looking down over the mezzanine railing, glaring down at Augie on the podium. Zachary had his pacifier pulsing in his mouth, and his arms were crossed over his chest, and he had this look of profound disgust on his face. And just as Augie began to read his first poem, my son bellowed, "No more poem shows!" So nobody wants to be heckled by a two-year-old. But the fact is, Augie took it well, and in fact, he has on several indelible occasions made known his own distaste for poem shows. If by that we can mean poetry that is ingratiating and reassuring and polite, that makes no demands either of its author or its audience. In a notorious essay published in Poetry Magazine a few years ago, he stirred up one of the most acrimonious debates in contemporary poetry circles in many years when he excoriated not just Garrison Keillor and his feel-good poem shows on the radio, but also popular poet Billy Collins, the American tendency to commercialize everything, even poetry, and the rampant industry of graduate writing programs, which he likened to hog farm waste and Ponzi schemes. Multivitamins are good for you, Kleinsaller wrote. Exercise, fresh air, and sex are good for you. Fruit and vegetables are good for you. Poetry is not. Are we not yet adult enough as a culture to acknowledge that the arts are not for everyone and that bad art is worse than no art at all? So for daring to air his strong opinions and take to task the national pastime of dumbing down the American literary heritage, for having the audacity to step on the vanity of some of his colleagues while remaining true to his ironclad artistic integrity, Kleinsaller has been labeled the bad boy of American poetry and the pugilist poet. His work assessed reductively by some of his detractors as crude tics of macho preening, that he is nothing more than a colloquial chronicler of losers, dive bars, and old girlfriends. Well, too bad for these folks. They're too intent on salving their own bruised egos to acknowledge that August Kleinsaller is, yes, a poet whose subject matter is robustly, unabashedly idiomatic and informal, but in service to a technically vigorous, acutely intentional art that responds on a deep level to the varied artists who have shaped his broadly learned imagination. William Carlos Williams and Thelonious Monk and Pound and Howlin' Wolf, the poets of the Tang Dynasty and Basil Bunting and Bartok. The contrapuntal quality of his poetry has perhaps been best captured by the late British poet Tom Gunn, who said, "The distinction of August Kleinsaller is that he has combined two opposed poetic modes. The first is the jokey improvised speech we associate with O'Hara. The second, the condensed, considered lapidary style of, let us say, Bunting. When Kleinsaller reconciles them, he creates something all his own and does so with an energy I find unequaled by other living poets." Please join me in welcoming August Kleinsaller.
On Johnny's time. When Johnny goes out, he's careful what gets into his time. He likes time plain, the better to taste it run out of him, like water out holes in the old town's corroded pipe. "What sort of business are you in?" the good burger always asks John. "Monkey business," is what John likes to tell him and won't crack a smile ever. That's John. But when Johnny goes out on Johnny's own time, he's out there doing the only one thing. He's burning off all the stillborn Johnnies, that hatched in his head in the night. And that John, he won't ever come home. Not until he's right. Actually, I didn't think this when I was putting this together, but Kate and I worked together 20 years ago, when I had Lila Wallace, and they hooked me up with a homeless veterans organization downtown, and I'd visit them and get them to write a bit. And one of the fellows was named Green, and Green told me this harrowing story, which might be true, it might not be true, but it's a hell of a tale. Green sees things in waves. Green, first thing each day, sees waves. The chair, armoire, overhead fixtures, you name it. Waves. Which, you might say, things really are. But Green just lies there a while, breathing long, slow breaths in and out through his mouth, like he was maybe seasick. Until in an hour or so, the waves simmer down, and then the trails and colors off of things, that all quiets down as well, and Green starts to think of washing up, breakfast even, with everything still moving around, colors, trails, and sounds from the street, and plumbing next door, vibrating. Of course, you might say that's what sound really is after all, vibrations. But Green, he's not thinking physics at this stage. Mm-mm. Our boy's only trying to get himself out of bed, get a grip. But sometimes, and this is the kicker, another party, shall we say, is in the room with Green, and Green knows this other party, and they do not get along, which understates it quite a bit, quite a bit. And Green knows that this other cat is an hallucination, right? But these two have a routine that goes way back, and Green starts hollering, throwing stuff until he's all shook up, whole day gone to hell. Bummer. Anyhow, the docs are having a look, see if they can't dream up a cocktail. But seems our boy ate quite a pile of acid one time. Clinical. Wow. Enough juice for half a block. Go, 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 little greenie. Blew the wiring out from behind his headlights, and now, no matter what, can't find the knob to turn off the show. Snow in North Jersey. I'm from North Jersey. Every once in a while you'll hear a vowel. I've done what I could to camouflage that most of my life. But snow in North Jersey. Snow is falling along the boulevard and its little cemeteries, hugged by transmission shops and on the stone bear in the park and the World War I monument, making a crust on the soldier with his chin strap and bayonet. It's blowing in from the west, over the low hills and meadowlands, swirling past the giant cracking stills that flare all night along the turnpike. It is with a terrible deliberateness that Mr. Ruiz reaches into his back pocket and counts out $18 in change for his lotto picks. While in the upstairs of 1,000 duplexes with a TV on, cancers, tick, 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 and the snow continues to fall and blanket these crowded rows of frame and brick with their heartbreaking porches and castellations and the red 68 Impala on blocks. And Joe, he's drinking again, and Myra's boy Tommy. In the old days, it would have been a disgrace. And Father Keenan's not been having a good winter. And it was nice enough this morning, till noon anyhow, with the sun sitting up there like a crown over a great big dome of mackerel sky. But it's coming down now, all right, falling on the Dixon Crucible Pencil Factory and on the Spur de Bayonne, along the length of the Pulaski Skyway and on St. Bridget's in the Alibi Saloon. Closed now. Oh, dear, I can't remember how long. And Lord Jesus, save us, they're still making babies. And what did you expect from this life? And they're calling for snow tonight and through tomorrow, an inch an hour over Nine Ridge Road in the old courthouse and along the sluggish gray Passaic as it empties itself into Newark Bay. And on Grandpa's store that sells curries now, and St. Peter's almost made it to the semis this year. It's snowing on the canal and rail yards, the bus barns and trucks, and on all the swells in their big houses along the river bluff. It's snowing on us all. And on a three-story fix-up off of Van Voorst Park, a young lawyer couple from Manhattan bought, where, for no special reason, in back of a closet, a thick, dusty volume from the 30s sits open, with a broken spine and smelling of mildew, to a chapter titled Social Realism. The dog stults. The dog stults pushed his paw pads into my neck, the warm, beaten leather deep under my chin, and let slip the one paw to up near my mouth with all the filth of the many blocks we trod, together trod, a well-moistened adenoidal sound, part sigh and part growl coming out of him. Transported, he seemed, in a slow-motion delirium as I tickled his chest and behind his ear, when he just then told me he'd tear out my throat, looked in my eye, and smiled, best as a dog can, then turned ruminative and spoke once more.
I simply have to knock out that essay Sassoon.
This would have been Sassoon, the war poet, understand. Dogs cannot write. My mother told me this. As for his talk, well, I took no special notice. His love of the war poets was well known. Stults would have been part bull and something else. Two friends walked by just then, handily as these things go, and inquired of us sitting down there on the stoop, not even a doorway merely, along a busy street. How went the day, and what pursuits was I attending? But what interested the two of them most were the tergiversations of the dog Stults. First beast, then scholar, then abject and adored. Say, who among us does not care to be undressed? He was not really my dog, you see, and of this made note, but were glad as well at my having a new dog in my life. It was a busy stretch of pavement, Amsterdam maybe, or Broadway, or farther down, just south of Chelsea. I can tell you it was the west side, of that I'm certain, and it was mild, spring-like, a few drops in the air. The friends passed along, and the dog Stults slept. He was not my dog, you know. He simply followed me out of what can only have been a very fine home. Such were his graces, his recondite tastes. But he was a killer, too, and rather smelled. I cannot accommodate another animal now. Please understand, I am between places. I will yearn for Stults, but no. Thank you. The strange hours travelers keep. The markets never rest. Always they are somewhere in agitation. Pork bellies, titanium, winter wheat. Electromagnetic ether peppered with photons. Treasure spewing from Unisys A15J mainframes across the firmament, soundlessly among the thunderheads and passenger jets as they make their night-long journeys across the oceans and steppes. Nebulae, incandescent frog spawn of information trembling in the claw of Scorpio, not an instant, then shooting away like an enormous cloud of starlings. Garbage scows move slowly down the estuary. The lights of the airport pulse in morning darkness. Food trucks, propane, tortured hearts. The reticent epistemologist Parks gets out checks the curb, reparks. Thunder of jets, peristalsis of great capitals. How pretty in her tartan scarf, her ruminative frown, ambiguity and reason locked in a slow, ferocious tango of, if not, why not? Hyper Berceuse, 3 a.m. You know, a Berceuse is like a lullaby, like Debussy's Clair de Lune. Imagine in all the debris of space, the countless trade names, Jugurtha, Tuolumne, Chert Farms. Some of these belong to you. Can you tell which ones? Each has its own sequence of microtones. Together, they make up a kind of tune, your tune. The ceiling and walls are star maps, breathing, alive. Those aren't stars, darling. That's your nervous system. Nana didn't take you to planetariums like this. Go on, touch. Lovely, isn't it? Like phosphorus on Thule Lake. Sweet summer midnights, shimmery, like applause under the skin. Can you make it out? Almost a hiss, an old shellac LP of white noise playing in the distance. Foolish, troublesome boy, that hapless adventuring of yours. Be very still. Now, can you hear it? Someone named Gutierrez, a dream, a Western. Outside the cantina with you, in the back seat of a ruined DeSoto, torn upholstery, vinyl mange, and the big old radio static frying what could only be a Dixie Cups tune. Things had gone terribly bad, and Slim, who drove us the whole long way through chaparral and dust, was in there now with them, asking for the money he had no right to even 10 years back when the fire was. Or so he says. They nearly killed him then, the fool, the braggart, the suicide kid, just itching after a good old-timey late afternoon cowboy send-off. Blood and gold and glinting sidearms. With us, stuck back there yet? Hove to in the back seat like two kids waiting for dad. When you touched me, the lightest of touches, the most unforeseen, carelessly along the wrist, I nearly came unglued. I mean, I knew about Ramon, that lovely boy, and for so long the two of you. I cherish that photo still, your white Tam O'Shanter, his red Trans Am. Then I became water. Then, from what had once been my chest, a plant made of light effloresced. Thus our adventure began, our slow-motion freefall through the vapors and oils. I stammered at your white flesh. And that's when the shooting began. Toys. The janitor washing the blackboard in Mrs. Turneau's class, February night, not too far from the border with Vermont, snowless and still a little stoned, thinks he caught a patch of aurora borealis out the window. Or maybe just a headlight off a cloud. Thank you for kissing me just then. It was getting to be rather a swarm in there with the tendrils, suckers, and shoots. No purpose, no end in sight. Syntax, a lost dynasty. That child is in terror. terror of himself, you can tell by his face how it's wrong in three parts, and with a helmet of busy, bruised air framing it. The parents, insensible, walk chattering behind. He's going to hurt himself. He's going to hurt himself soon. Look at the colored liquids and string beans in a jar, pickled. The carved mahogany sideboard, so old and so dark, like Europe. The gaunt timpanist with the visiting symphony orchestra sits by himself on a concrete bench in the abandoned pedestrian mall, Sunday with dead oak and maple leaves skittering past in this lovely provincial city renowned for its love of the arts. She's a drunkard, but still pretty, 40-ish, oddly athletic. The sidewalk might as well be the top of a sawhorse. She walks so daintily with her pint in a small brown bag, when suddenly a terrific boom ripples across the sky overhead. Brilliant afternoon. It's the celebrated Blue Angels rocketing east to west in their Tomcat fighters, nearly on top of each other, tight diamond formation, their contrails feathering behind, come apart and vanish into sky. The hobbyist in his room, alone under the blue turret, his work of many years now done. Each row of matchsticks flawlessly joined, canted, plumb. The fading smell of epoxy. You were dozing, Uttar Pradesh, you were dozing over Uttar Pradesh well after the shadows of Annapurna swept across the big plane's starboard wing, dreaming a peevish little dream of Stinky Phil, your playground tormentor from 50 years before, his red earmuffs and curious cigar voice, vivid as the tapioca you used to gag on at the end of Thursday lunch, when the captain's serene, patriarchal voice suggested you buckle up moments before the plane jumped, then yawed in an air pocket and dropped 500 feet. Oh, shit. There goes the Parcheesi board and what's left of a very bold Shiraz. Melissa purses her lips in the compact mirror, turns a quarter left, then right a tad, scowls at her mascara and snaps it shut with a sigh. You are the preeminent colorist of your generation, of your era. Some would suggest a fraud with your grand chevelure of white hair and cape. Mother would certainly not disagree, but here you are again, crossing continents, 6 miles above the petty quarrels, the tossed green salads and car wrecks, to receive yet another prize, a ribbon, a princely sum in a foreign capital, and a spread on the Sunday culture page. How very far away now seem your student days. Happy, hungry, cooking up manifestos, turpentine, pussy, stale cigarette smoke. It was evident from the start. It screamed at you from billboards, fabric shops, museums. And no one else saw it. No one but you. Amazing. Then half a lifetime to execute it in paint. What a long time with one idea. But still, it was a doozy, put you in the art books and kept you there for life. There will be a car waiting when you arrive. Kremer is visiting with the Philharmonic and will do the Sibelius, your favorite. You recall meeting him some years ago at a dinner in Cologne, I think it was, an intense young man, but very pleasant. Right. Now you remember the evening, the lugubrious molding and burgundy drapes. Ah, yes, and the most memorable Hassenpfeffer. The tartar swept the tartar swept across the plain in their furs and silk panties, snub-nosed monkey men with cinders for eyes attached to their ponies like centaurs, forcing the snowy passes of the Carpathians, streaming from defiles like columns of ants, arraying their hosts in a vasty wheel, white, gray, black, and chestnut steeds, 10,000 each to a quadrant, turning at the Genu's command this terrible pinwheel, gathering speed like a Bulgar dance, faster and faster until it explodes. Columns of horsemen peeling away in all the four directions, hard across the pushta, dust from their hooves darkening the sky. They fall upon village and town like raptors, like tigers, like wolves on the fold, mauling the zazas and leaving them senseless in puddles of goaty drool, smashing balalaikas, ripping the ears off hussars and pissing in the wounds. They for whom the back of a horse is their only country, for whom a roof and four walls is like unto a grave, and a city, a city, a pullulating sore that exists to be scourged. Stinky dumb nomads with blood still caked on shield and cuirass and the yellow loose from the dunes of the Taklamakan and the corridor of Kansu between their toes and caught in their scalps. Like storm clouds in the distance fast approaching with news of the steppes, the lagoons and bitter lakes, edicts, torchings, infestation, the smoke of chronicles. Finding their way by the upper reaches of the Salinga and the Irtysh to Issyk-Kul, the Aral, and then the Caspian, vanquishing the Bashkirs and Alans by their speed, outstripping rumor, tireless mounts, short-legged and strong, from whose backs arrows are expertly dispatched as fast as they can be pulled from the quiver. Samarkand, Bukhara, Herat, Nishapur, more violent in every destruction. This race of men which had never before been seen with their roving fierceness, scarcely known to ancient documents, from beyond the edge of Scythia, from beyond the frozen ocean, pouring out of the Caucasus, surpassing every extreme of ferocity, from the Don to the Dniester, the Black Sea to the Pripet marshes, laying waste the Ostrogoth villages, taking with them every last cookie, then dicking the help. These wanton boys of nature, who shot forward like a bolt from on high, routing with great slaughter all they could come to grips with in their wild career, their beautiful, shifting formations, thousands advancing at the wave of a scarf, then doubling back or making a turn with their diabolical sallies and feints, remorseless and in poor humor. So they arrived at the gates of Christendom. Thank you. Obad on 12th Street. The skylight silvers, and a faint shudder from the underground travels up the building steel. Dawn breaks across this wilderness of roofs with their old wooden storage tanks and caps of louvered cowlings moving in the wind. Your back, raised hip and thigh, well-tooled as a rounded baluster on a lathe of shadow and light. Noir. The light emission diodes stare, incandescent crab eyes. Foghorns trade calls in the night as if lost, seeking one another out. Sometimes in the key of A, sounding out there by the cliffs. Sometimes in G or C, depending on how the fog is blowing, but always at their loudest right before dawn. A fine rain falls. The actors scuttle back to their trailers after the hours of hitting their spots. Muffed scenes, take after take, shivering out there under the helium lamps. Another crap over budget homage to Hammett and John Alton, Magyar master of the shadow game. Fog, steam, and smoke. Bad news behind the slatted blinds, the half-illumined face, and pistols retort. Exhausted, feeling a little debauched after too much weasel, cop, and tough, good time Mabel down on her luck, the canny Chinaman named Wu. Three of them play cards. The other two, after a few lines of blow, screw. The front is blowing in from the south. You can taste it in the air, smell it. The flags on the downtown buildings begin to snap. It starts out there on the Pacific, 1,000 miles off the China coast, and comes across on the westerlies. That's what it does this time of year. I've been out here a long time, every year. You can set your clock by it. Orientation weekend. At the Hotel Oblivion, Airport Drive, Mezzanine, Conference Center B, PowerPoint presentation number one, Career Enhancement Strategy. Mary Ray's pink ice service trembles in the aftershock of some astral seizure, so remote and faint only the weevil's foreleg dares say, yes, 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 it's true. Next up, team building exercises. Woof, woof. Burgundy carpet, big yellow dots, that new smell, glycol ethers, 4-phenylcyclohexane, and latex backing. Break. Free coffee, light snacks, get acquainted. Pardon me, Miss Carnoustie, is that your panty line or a silken esker of longing? Have an hallucination. Have a bagel. We had an issue under discussion here regarding the lighting, I believe, that tenebrous strip beyond the chandelier's orb. Hey, help me out here. Not now, Peg, I'm teething. Are we ready for the evening thought shower? Hold on, the jacaranda's gone missing. Waiter, some more vitamin water and hurry. Wow, here it comes. 36,000 blasts of ink per second and four, count them, four brilliant colors and with no telltale digital trace. I see a hand up. Mr. Gomez, are we still on the same page? Anniversary. The setting here is Austin, Texas, in the summer. Anniversary. You'd figure the hawk for an isolate thing, commanding the Empyrean, taking his ease in the thermals and wind, until that retinal flick, the plunge and shriek, cruelly perfect at what he is, with crepe myrtle igniting the streets and flowering pansy underfoot. I'd get out there just after dawn each day, before the sun made it over the mesquite and honey locust. Cliff swallows rocketed low over grass, dragonflies darted above. Every day on the heels of first bird song, juice heads sleeping rough by the culvert, before the heat, before the ebb and flow of cicada whir swallowed the world, when the crepe myrtle was still in bloom, when it was the flowering pansies' time in the park in untended lots and still a touch of cool in the air. I remember once a red tail perched close by on a branch of a utility pole. Maybe he came down for a better look, but I think it was so that I might better see him who reigned over these few acres and beyond, and what it was about him so overmastering. An ugly sheen encouraged some gold in his russet mantle. His belly was white. Look at me, he seemed to be insisting. Behold, a pure, wild, heartless thing, beautiful and horrible, nothing in between. I one day saw him tearing at his prey. He was in the crook of a tree, low and close at hand, fixed on it, drunk with it, mercilessly at it, the sound like a cleaver tearing through meat, cruelly what he was, nothing else. But on another day, not long after, I heard him perched high on a branch, calling out, crying out in distress, piteously, Kiar, Kiar, a harsh descending sound. And unrelenting. Ki-ar, ki-ar. Panic or wound, terrible in his dismay. Until suddenly, from some other corner of sky, another hawk flew down to join him, not right there on the same branch, but on another close by. And soon after that, off they flew together, drifting, spiraling, higher and higher in partnered loops, wheeling and diving, enraptured by all they were able to do, not as separate beings, but as two. How many times? Master claps of thunder, wrath of God thunder, sitting on the porch at night and waiting for the rain to fall in Texas. Or at the Cantina Grill Express in Denver Airport, between flights, watching as you dab at some hot sauce on your chin. How many times, how many places have I said, I love you? How many does it take to change a light bulb? Watching smoke from the sugar beet plant drift east to Minnesota from the hotel window in Fargo, how many times you are beautiful? The Swami, after an extended meditation in his hut in the pine forest, many kilometers distant from the nearest village and at an altitude from which one can see not only that village, but the next and the next, takes out a cigarette, lights it, and inhales deeply. The term Baroque probably originates from a Portuguese word barroco, which means approximately a lopsided pearl. When the Barocco came over the hill with its cerulean vaults and golden exhortations, Otto in the tower took leave of his flesh, attending to the rumble in the near beyond. Up the staircase of the Dolomites and along the length of the turquoise river, streaming in channels of differing hue, it bounded like a beach ball across the great passes, the summer pastures, flattening all that came before it, down the slope, through woodland and paddock, coming to rest but a furlong from the thorned hedge of Otto and his forebears' village. And there, sweating dew, matted with pine needles, grape mash, insects, rodents, all manner of grasses, like a vast lopsided globe, opalescent, trembling, a planet unto itself, very like a planet. There it sat, a colossus of hesitation, blocking what remained of the afternoon light and emitting a kind of tuneful bleating, two parts piccolo, one perhaps trombone, a most remarkable phenomenon to behold. The villagers trembled from behind mud walls. Otto thence convened the elders. The alp horn was taken up and blown, first a necklace of quarter notes, then one long, and from the forests all around, like fleas off a hound, came the wood woes from their rustic nests, a swarm of hairy calibans, waving pointed sticks, chisels, flints, hatchets, and cudgels, and fell upon it, poking and flailing. You'd have thought it was just a big piñata. While from inside came an ominous, strange music, first a silvery harmonic fuzz, then some spectral pedal tones that suggested the tolling of bells. Then an agitated chromaticism. Then, like lava from deep in a seething volcano, out burst a geyser of foam, a foam of stucco and plaster, covering butcher yard and meadow, orchard and cow path, pigs at their acorns, hares, bears, and hans dozing behind the refectory. Churigorisque, like whipped cream, suddenly dripped off half-timbered houses, the town hall and chapel, their corpses stacked high like cordwood, dead Styrians and Savoyards, and that Doyen among rivers, the Enns, for no good reason, o'erflowing its banks, and Otto. Otto the pious, spellbound. Ovals, porticos, diagonals, whorls, staircases, credenzas, pooty galore, wine ran like squirrels in the forest, and down from the sky above fell ribbons of damask, of silk, then a fine rain, more a mist, colored purple in patches, or ochre, indigo, or gold, inlaying plain gardens with mother-of-pearl, pageants sprouted like mushrooms, trompe-d'oeil windows opened room upon room, and in the trees passacaglias of birdsong. Not a birch nor gable left unfestooned, the valley awash in high color, and upon itself enfolding, trebly enfolding, until what had been there, there, and there, earthbound, fixed in repose, all now in concert, reaching heavenward, moved. If I have. Let me read one for Patrick Lannan and Christy here, because Brentwood is in it, along with several other things. I became enchanted with the German exile community in Los Angeles in the 30s and 40s, and among those appearing in here is Theodore Adorno. But he's not alone. Rose Exile. The parade floats trundle north along South Orange in the clammy darkness and floral decay of pre-dawn Pasadena. Turning right onto the long stretch of Colorado Boulevard, following exactly the parade route of the celebrated Tournament of Roses. Burbling from speakers hidden in the palms and sycamores, one can just make out the aching majesty of Richard Wagner's Siegfried Idyll and Rhine Journey, Furt Wangler, who else, conducting the Wiener Philharmoniker. First, in perfect scale, bright vinyl fringe bedecking the bottom, a bungalow-sized replica of the Vienna Court Opera, is followed by yet another float, the Café Griesenstädel, also from Old Vienne, with its Jugendstil lamps and marble-topped tables. A local bit player, having grown out his sideburns, solemnly writes down notes on a stave while nibbling a soccer tort. Richard Strauss, let us say, at work on an opera. And what are we now to think of Richard Strauss? Following next on a platform atop a huge Frankfurter float comes the co-author of The Dialectic of Enlightenment, seated behind a desk and clapping his hands to his ears in a mechanical fashion, not unlike a wind-up toy. This is not the desk later memorialized on Adorno Platz in Bachenheim, but the desk from his Brentwood home at 316 South Kenter, just a few doors down from the OJ unpleasantness years later. The tall, elaborate Bismarck-era monstrosity, with its multitude of small drawers, and beside it the carved wooden chair on which the great man now sits in extreme agitation, crying out, "Wo die Ohre ist! Wo die Ohre ist!" The source of his distress is standing directly to his right, in a form-fitting sequin gown, singing in a voice one critic described as trumpet clean, penny whistle piercing, Wurlitzer wonderful. You will know of whom I'm speaking. It is the brass diva herself, Ethel Merman, belting out a hair-raising version of "I Get a Kick Out of You." "What's with the long face, Pudge?" she growls, realizing she has not moved Wiesengrund Adorno, not one eeny, weeny bit. Loosen up and live a little, Mr. Big Shot Weisenheimer. At this moment, bombers are assembling into their formations over Europe. Dishes on their rubber racks are almost now completely dry. Someone is inventing color TV. Millions of cans of corn niblets sit in the darkness on shelves across the Midwest. The streets remain empty. The circumstances had been made clear to the participants at the start. Trucks rumble in the distance across the Arroyo Seco, while the first birds of the day, unbothered as ever, commence their singing. Thank you. Sleeping it off in Rapid City on a 700-foot thick shelf of Cretaceous pink sandstone, Nell Mezzo, sixth floor, turn right at the elevator, the hotel of the century, elegant dining, dancing solarium, around the block from the Black Hills School of Beauty and campaign headquarters of one Jack Billion. Together we can move forward. The exact center of the Oglala known universe, Kante Wamago Gwakwe, or only 30 miles or so away, southwest, off Highway 87, I waken to the sound of the DM&E rattling through the sleeping town, sounding its horn as it snakes its way through, hauling coal from nowhere, through nowhere, and then some. Old rocks and distance, a few hawks overhead. 4 a.m., per una selva oscura. Quack, 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 shrieks the velociraptor in the closed dinosaur shop. Vroom, vroom, roars of triceratops like Texas thunder. They keep the tape loop going through the night. Always have done. No one knows why. The Bible store respires in its sanctum as if in an outsized black glass humidor. This is a sacred ground, a holy place. 4 a.m. in a sacred place. I can tell this is a sacred place. I needn't be told. It's in the air. I feel it. This old heritage hotel, this is a sacred place. The tour buses are lined up outside it, awaiting the countless pilgrims. On the floor, my shoe, under the bed, even my shoe is blessed. The Lord's blessing is everywhere to be found. The lambs of Christ are among us. You can tell by the billboards with fetuses out there on the highway, through the buzzing, sodium-lit nights, semis grinded out on the interstate, hauling toothpaste, wheels of Munster rapeseed oil. Blessed is the abundance, blessed the commerce across the Cretaceous hogback. 100-million-year-old Lakota sandstone, clays, shale, gypsum, and down through the basins of ancient seabeds, past the souvenir shops and empty missile silos, the ghosts of 98-foot-long titans and minutemen, 150,000 pounds of thrust, stainless steel, nickel alloy-coated warheads, quartz ceramic warheads webbed in metal honeycomb, 8-megaton payloads, range 6,300 miles. Noli me tangere. God bless America. We're right on top of it, baby. This is why you're here. Close enough, anyhow. Just 11 miles west of Castle Rock, in a pasture right off 79, the middle of the heart of this great land. There's a sign. This is a sacred place. Up there in the hills of Est Ponderosa, feathered batholith, you can see it from space. 2-billion-year-old exposed rock rising from the prairie, a faint blue shape on the horizon when approaching from a distance, but seen close at hand, grim and black. Paha, Sapa, savage cliffs and precipices, fantastic forms, sometimes resembling towns, some castellated fortresses, a sacred place. Custer once came through in the summer of 74 with that mustache and golden hair, and espied here the multitude of flowers, 17 varieties in a space of 20 feet. One could pick 7 different kinds at dinner without ever leaving one's seat. It was a strange sight, he wrote, to glance back at the advancing columns of cavalry and behold the men with beautiful bouquets in their hands. A sacred place, the great white fathers dwell in these hills, noses and foreheads blasted out of granite, crazy horse too, 30 stories high, an enormous pod of migmatite glowering east. Big chiefs everywhere, on every street corner in town. Life-size bronze likenesses. See the Chicana brushing President Van Buren, bless her. Bless the Chicana in pink rayon, the dutiful city worker, brushing the statue with a toothbrush in the night. There's Nixon at St. Joseph and Fifth, seated, hands folded on his lap the way he did, in the midst of delicate negotiations with Mao. This is what it says at the base. Bless them, Nixon and Mao both, men of peace, soldiers of God. The bronze is cold in the high plains night. The eyes they gaze out of her holes here at the exact dead center of America, or close enough, just north of here off Highway 79. The buffalo roam in these hills. Paha, Sapa. The bison graze in the shadow of these hills. One angry bull tosses a Harley 30 feet in the air, a big fat biker attached to it, 30 feet as well. The sacred bison. He would have ridden among the sacred bison, the biker, ridden as if he were one of their own. Tatanka, Tatanka, cries Kevin Costner. Tatanka, concurs Kicking Bird. Tatanka, agrees Wind in His Hair. Bless Kevin Costner. I saw that one on widescreen in Dolby Surround Sound. Kevin Costner stayed in this hotel. Babe Ruth and Calvin Coolidge, too. This is a sacred place. I have come here from far away, after many years of wandering, disillusion, and found Circe's here from all my cares. Circe's here from doubt, here at the center of it all, on a great slab of Mesozoic rock, this sanctified ground. Here. Yes, here. The dead, solid center of the universe. At the heart of America. Thank you.